I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, Professor Harvey J. K., author of Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again, joins us to discuss his newest book, FDR on Democracy, The Greatest Speeches and Writings of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, if you haven't heard Harvey on the show before, well, you're in for a treat because he is a brilliant orator and an incredible historian and sociologist. And we are going to get into the legacy of FDR and what can be gleaned from it in the 21st century. But not only that, Harvey will also give his thoughts on the post-Bernie race to the White House, which is pitting Donald Trump against Joe Biden. A lot of Bernie supporters are rather disheartened by this turn of events. They feel like they have no options. And Harvey has his own views on this matter. Should the left support Joe Biden or not? All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to our conversation with Harvey J. K. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Professor Harvey J. K., author of the new book, well, editor, I should say, editor and also curator. Wrote the introduction. Yeah, curator. I think that would be the best title. FDR on Democracy, the Greatest Speeches and Writings of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, available now, I believe, from Skyhorse, correct?
Skyhorse Publishing, right, in New York City. And it's on all the normal, all the usual suspects of websites and independent bookstores. If you contact independent bookstores, they can get it for you pretty quickly.
So let's start by talking about FDR on Democracy. I know you've had a long interest in FDR, and also you've written a few books about Thomas Paine. Why this book and why now? Why this collection of his speeches and writings? What do you feel is still important about FDR in the 21st century?
Okay, well, you know, the old expression, timing is everything, but here's the thing. Yeah, so for a start, as a sidebar, Thomas Paine is my lifelong hero. And Franklin Roosevelt was always, he was like a family icon, you might say. My parents were greatest generation people. The idea of voting for a Republican was completely out of the question. And to their minds, Franklin Roosevelt was the greatest president ever. My father served in World War II. In the Battle of the Bulge, he was in the tanks, came home a wounded Purple Heart veteran, though he was in fine shape, after a recovery period. But the thing is, Franklin Roosevelt was a major figure as a presidential personage in my family. And when I was growing up, I also remember very clearly that when Democratic conventions were held, and when I was a little boy and even a teenager, it was not unusual to see images of Franklin Roosevelt at the Democratic conventions as a reminder to Americans on the part of the Democrats that they were, if you like, the heirs to the Roosevelt legacy, to the Roosevelt tradition, and that that was what they wanted to carry on. In fact, the one convention I'm really thinking of is 1960, when Jack Kennedy won the nomination. And the platform that the Democratic Party issued that was authored by someone who had been in the Roosevelt sub-cabinet actually said that the Democrats remained as committed as ever to realizing the economic Bill of Rights that Roosevelt had proclaimed as a vision for Americans in the State of the Union Address of 1944. So in essence, the Democrats, for at least for a while, even if they weren't as progressive as their idol or icon, Franklin Roosevelt, had not forgotten what it meant to be a Democrat. Well, here's the thing. So what's curious is when I wrote my Thomas Paine and the Promise of America book that was published in 2005, it's a book, if anyone gets a chance to read it, in which I not only talk about Paine's life and labors, but I go on for the remainder of the book to lay out Thomas Paine's legacy, which conservatives and reactionaries and indeed Republicans for generations tried to deny and suppress. And it was really only in 1942, when Franklin Roosevelt gave a speech at the outset of America's entry into World War II, that for the first time ever since probably Thomas Jefferson, an American president quoted and embraced Thomas Paine's memory. And when I wrote about that, I got all the more fascinated by Franklin Roosevelt, who I already knew to be this liberal progressive president. So I ended up going on to write the book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And I think what I discovered there was two things. First of all, that the real memory of Franklin Roosevelt, not unlike the memory of Paine in some ways, had been suppressed. That Roosevelt was a far more radical president than liberals who had dominated both the historical profession and the Democratic Party had basically attended to. And moreover, his progressivism, if you like, in my term, radicalism, had to do with the fact that he encouraged those we came to call the greatest generation to not only rise to the occasion of the Great Depression and then the war against fascism, World War II. He also encouraged them enough, if you like, to move in a progressive direction that they ended up pushing him, if not further, decidedly faster in a progressive direction than he might ever have planned to go. So as a consequence, the New Deal years witnessed not only the first New Deal, but an even more progressive, or at least in many ways, apparently progressive, second New Deal of 1935, which saw the enactment of Social Security and the National Labor Relations Act. But I could, you know, and maybe we'll get to it, I could lay out a whole series of initiatives that came to be known as the alphabet soup of agencies that he initiated during those Depression years in order to have the New Deal, if you like, pursue relief, recovery, reconstruction, and reform. But what we often forget, and this is also part of the Roosevelt legacy, is that Americans themselves were not simply followers. They themselves, especially working people, but not only working people, created their own set of alphabet soup agencies. So you get either the creation or enact, or if you like, initiation of labor unions. The United Mine Workers really did push even harder. United Auto Workers, United Rubber Workers, United Steel Workers. I mean, there was an incredible mobilization of labor, not only to fight the Great Depression, but by labor and working people themselves to create voices in industry, which we came to call in the third, not we, but Americans came to know as industrial democracy in the 1930s. There was also the American Youth Congress, a whole host of African-American organizations pushing for equal rights. I mean, it was the case that if you think about the Great Depression, one has to come to grips not only with FDR and the New Deal, but also the energies of working people, men and women. So as I worked on the book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, I came to see that time in a wholly new way, and also to see the degree to which the forces mobilizing against it after World War II succeeded to some extent, and then succeeded all the more dramatically in the 1970s. So when I finished the book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, I had planned to go on, and you know that there was the book that we talked about maybe two times ago, Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. And in that book, I tried to make the case by way of the various speeches and essays that I included there, my own speeches and essays, that what we saw in American history was a sort of a persistent radicalism, which really did emerge in a truly dramatic way at critical moments, at crisis times, mortal crisis times. the Revolution, the Civil War, the campaigns against the Great Depression, the FDR years, and the war against fascism, and then again in the 1960s. And the point about that is that I saw that we had entered into a crisis time, that we were now in our own mortal crisis. This is even before the, you know, the coronavirus crisis we face. I'm talking about 45 years of class war. So my idea was, in the wake of putting those speeches together, I took on a contract to bring together, to collect and edit, or as I said before to you, curate speeches of FDR that really reveal the radicalism that he sensed in American life and that he sought to articulate. So the collection of speeches includes speeches that haven't been seen, that weren't lost, but they haven't been seen in any kind of significant public way in decades, if not, you know, 50 years, 75 years. So why FDR? Well, looking ahead to 2020, as I said in my book, Take Hold of Our History, it was time for us to remember who we are and to remember what we're capable of doing. And I thought FDR's words would come in handy. Now, we could segue, but I won't do it right now, into the degree to which I was hoping Bernie Sanders would embrace that legacy and maybe regularly cite or even recite the words that were included in that book.
I think that would be a good segue, actually. But I don't think it's just Bernie, although I wish Bernie would have talked more about FDR and this sort of tradition you're speaking of, this sort of radical tradition. It's almost like the Democratic Party as a whole almost wants to forget about FDR at times. I mean, there's still references to FDR and whatnot, but he's almost become a hollow figure.
Yeah, well, here's one of the things that I try to bring out in the book. First of all, that, and this has to do with Bernie and maybe Bernie's failings in some ways, is that FDR really did believe, he had a certain confidence in his fellow citizens, and he really did have a sense of American history as a radical story. Pieces that I didn't include in there were like the introduction to some of his own speeches, and I've got the whole set of them sitting here next to me by my desk. He regularly refers to the American story as a revolution in itself. He doesn't deny, you know, the tragedies, but he sees that revolution. But the other thing is, and this was really critical, is that from the start of his presidency to the time of his death in 1945, 12 years of presidential administration, FDR really does have in mind the creation of by the way, I'm going to use a word he did not use, a social democratic America. And I make this point because FDR was rooted in capital P progressivism of the early part of the 20th century. The progressivism we associate with figures like maybe Teddy Roosevelt, to some extent Woodrow Wilson, though I hate to include him in a terribly positive way quite often, but all the more so Robert La Follette, the governor and senator from the state of Wisconsin, and others. I mean, it was a major movement among middle class and a whole host of politicians, Republican and Democratic. So he's rooted in that kind of progressivism, but he didn't actually call himself a capital P progressive ever. He was a Democrat with a capital D. However, as I try to show by way of the inclusion of a speech he gave in 1912, even if then in 1912, he's clearly looking for a way to move beyond the choice of capitalism and some kind of authoritarian, you know, socialism or some other force. He's looking for what would come to be called social democracy. And this regularly appears in his thinking and in his words all the way through to the time of his presidency. And by the way, even in the 1920s, when the Republican had a firm control over the presidency, FDR would talk to students. Like, he went up to Milton Academy. I include a speech he gave at Milton Academy in 1926. In which he told these young men, I don't know if there was a co-ed school at the time, but at least the young men in their teens, that he didn't worry about change. What he worried about is that if conservatives ruled America for too long, that the American idea would be suppressed, truly suppressed. And it was important, he said, to encourage young people to think in terms of change. And it was clear from the speech itself that he meant progressive or liberal change. Now, for Roosevelt then, he's going to try to create a new kind of liberalism, not the liberalism of the classical 18th century variety of, you know, basically free markets, you know, a laissez-faire kind of government position regarding the economy. He's really going to develop, and I say again, he didn't use the term social democracy. So I include a speech he gave in 1932 amongst a host of really remarkable speeches in his first campaign, which he gave at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And in that, he lays out the story of America and how Americans had lost the social contract that the Declaration of Independence implied. And he actually cites, and this is very important all the way through his presidency, the words life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which he believes is a license for what we would think of as social democracy. That it means you have a right to life, and to have a right to life, it means you have to have the wherewithal to live, the right to a job that provides a standard of living, that an American standard of living, as it used to be called, liberty, a certain kind of freedom, not only the freedom of the capitalist, but also the freedom of the worker, which might well mean the right to organize and have one's voice represented in industrial activity. And last but not least, the pursuit of happiness, which, you know, we've seen various perversions of that idea. So he actually calls in 1932, in a speech he gives before a host of people in San Francisco who are clearly of the bourgeois class, of the upper class, and he says, we need an economic declaration of rights. And this will reappear when he calls in 1941 for the Four Freedoms, and in 1944 for the Economic Bill of Rights, which Bernie himself regularly did refer to. So really, we've got this amazing figure in Franklin Roosevelt. Look, let me be clear. I'm sure listeners to our podcast tonight will say to themselves, well, what about, you know, the internment of the Japanese Americans in World War II? What about the fact that he didn't desegregate the military in World War II? What about the fact that he never signed into law an anti-lynching bill? What about the fact that he did not persuade Congress to lift the quotas on immigration to allow a greater number of Jewish refugees into the country? He was not a saint. He made some terrible decisions. I mean, if you believe in something like heaven, he'll have to answer to St. Peter. He would have had to answer to St. Peter for them. Nevertheless, he was truly a progressive Democrat with a capital and a small D. And most American, and the overwhelming majority of Americans understood that. And even those who may well have suffered as a consequence of his terrible decisions that he made along the way, fought like hell, the Great Depression, and fought like hell in the military in World War II, because they understood what America was meant to be, in good part because of the speeches he gave. So, and really, the book, so, you know, to go back to your original question, I wanted not only some political figures to pay attention to these ideas and these words. I think it's a case, I've said this to you before, I think Americans carry a kind of cultural memory, a political memory that doesn't automatically arise. It requires, if you like, Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist, used to talk about the role of the intellectual, was the idea of speaking to people in a way that encourages their fundamental working class sensibilities and empowers them. And in his own way, I mean, obviously he's no outright socialist, FDR, and decidedly not a Marxist, but he is a small D Democrat, and he wanted to speak to what he believed to be the fundamental sense of what it meant to be an American, and that is a kind of progressive or radical sensibility.
There's also something to be said about the good neighbor policy, too, that's oft forgotten about FDR's legacy. The aspect of, like, repealing the Platt Amendment, getting out of Haiti, negotiating with Mexico to nationalize its foreign oil assets. Like, these are aspects of American imperialism, however you may define that, that are a softer kind of power, I suppose. It's something that hasn't been seen and we don't really discuss when it comes to the long history of the post-Monroe doctrine in the United States.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's an aspect of FDR's legacy that goes oft undiscussed and I think should be brought up a bit more among leftist circles.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think it's the fact that leftists do an injustice to history and to themselves by failing to see the degree to which that we may well speak of American imperialism, but not all presidential imperial activities are the same, right? I mean, Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt may share the same last name, and indeed they were cousins, but Teddy Roosevelt was an imperialist, okay? And Franklin Roosevelt was a man who was willing to step back from that classical imperial role. And I like the way you put it, soft power was probably more in his mind than anything else.
That actually brings something to mind. I mean, what's interesting about FDR is that he comes from a background that I would say is sort of the upper crust within America.
Absolutely.
And yet he argues, what was that? Aristocratic.
Yeah, I mean, I call it Hudson River gentry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's just interesting to me because it seems like he understood that if we wanted things to keep going in America, you had to make concessions to the people. Like, it seemed he understood, even within that sort of upper crust that he belonged to, that you can't just obliterate the everyday person economically.
Okay, here's the key thing, which, because that fascinated me when I was working on the first book, The Fight for the Four Freedoms. And I tried to see if what he himself had to say about his small d democratic aspirations and hopes. And some of it's artificial. But one thing that I think is important is that he doesn't come from the late 19th century Gilded Age capitalist class. He comes from an older moneyed class, you know, one that goes way back to the times, you know, of the Mayflower, you might say. And his view of things as part of that Hudson River gentry was that those corporate industrialist types, you know, call them, whether we're talking about Frick or later, you know, Henry Ford or the Rockefellers, the folks who made their millions, if not billions, in the late 19th century second industrial revolution, who literally became the titans of industry of the Gilded Age, and in the 20th century, you know, dominated industries like, you know, General Motors and DuPont Chemical, those kinds of things. He viewed them very suspiciously. Okay. I mean, you know, to him, they may have been richer than he was, but they had an antagonism and hostility to working people that he just didn't share. And I think that's crucial. I'm not making him out to be, again, I don't want to make him out to be the organizer of labor, but it is important to realize that he honestly believed that if American democracy did not constantly extend and deepen, that there was a threat. I include the speech he gave on the eve of the midterm elections of 1938. The speech is given like November 2nd, the evening of, I think it's November 2nd, 1938. And he's calling for Americans to vote liberally, as he put it. Vote for liberals. Okay. And at that time, you could vote for liberals who were not only Democrats, but you could also vote for liberal Republicans, okay? In fact, he himself was closer in many ways to the progressives in Wisconsin, capital P progressives, than he was to the Democratic Party. He turned his back in a couple of occasions on the Democrats in Wisconsin in favor of the La Follettes here in Wisconsin. So he actually says in a speech, which I love, I hope I can get it open fast enough. There's a great paragraph in this one. It's not terribly long. I'm gonna actually read it if you don't mind, okay?
Awesome.
It says, as of today, this is a national radio broadcast. He says, as of today, fascism and communism and old line Tory Republicans are not threats to the continuation of our form of government. But I venture the challenging statement that if American democracy ceases to move forward as a living force, seeking day and night by peaceful means to better the lot of our citizens, then fascism and communism, aided unconsciously perhaps by old line Tory republicanism, will grow in strength in our land. And I can tell you that that may actually be some of the most relevant words for today. Just think about it. 45 years of class war on working people, pursued by capital, conservatives, and even the neoliberals, the Democratic likes of Carter, the likes of Biden, for that matter, okay? And what he would have said is, look, 45 years, I'm amazed we don't have some kind of neo-fascism in the United States already, given the fact that democracy, though it has expanded in certain ways, especially regarding the rights of women and the rights of gays and lesbians, it's clearly the case, right, that working people have suffered for 45 years in a decline in their standard of living and in their rights in the workplace. I mean, it's just truly abominable what we've seen. And what have we now seen? We have a president in the White House who's not simply a moron. He is also a wannabe fascist. Okay. And let's not forget that he's enabled not simply by those who have been so angry that in 2016 they voted for him, but also by the Republican Party, including traditional Republicans themselves, only a handful of whom perhaps have really split from the party and become part of that never Trump kind of stuff. And by the way, those folks, many of whom are neoconservatives, ought to be confessing their sins for having enabled 45 years of class war that brought us the likes of Donald Trump and has reduced the Democratic Party in some ways to having to nominate Joe Biden. And we'll talk about Biden, I'm sure, in a little while.
You know, it's interesting. I wanted to bring this up. I feel as if that 45 years you mentioned, it has led to a complete derangement of our senses in some ways. I mean, if you think about after FDR, a president like Eisenhower, even an Eisenhower wouldn't have like tried to repeal all the social change that FDR made. Like he wouldn't have thought to get rid of all these New Deal programs.
No, even
Reagan, even he would have, despite all the numerous faults, wouldn't have acted near as vociferously as a modern day Republican.
Well, actually, as long as you brought that up, Casey, and then I just want to respond quickly. He actually would have loved for many years to end all of the New Deal legacy, including Social Security, including the Tennessee Valley Authority and public ownership of electric power and generation of electric power. He would have loved.
Do you mean Reagan or Eisenhower?
Reagan. However, he knew one time he made some reference to it in an interview and he got lambasted for even suggesting that he would do so. I think it was in 77 or 78. And later, he sort of reduced his attacks to attacks on the Great Society years of Lyndon Johnson. So I don't want to create any kind of mythology about Reagan. Reagan was a right winger whose career was based post Roosevelt, because he was actually a Roosevelt Democrat when he was a younger man. But later, he lambasted the Roosevelt legacy. Now, Eisenhower, however, in 1954, on two occasions, recorded occasions, one in a letter to one of his two brothers, and in another in a conversation with his own press secretary, basically spoke of scorn regarding the conservatives and reactionaries who wanted him to go after the FDR legacy. And I'm having to paraphrase it. There was a letter he wrote to his brother, who was a right winger. And he said to him, "You got to be joking. Any party that goes after Social Security, labor law, the subsidy to farmers," and he lays it all out, the whole FDR legacy in one paragraph. He says, "Any party who tries to go after that stuff is never going to be heard from again in this country." And why did he know that, Eisenhower? He knew it because he had been the general that led the American forces in Europe, that led the greatest generation that enacted those things and fought for those things. He knew better than to do that. Reagan basically became the champion of the right wing, and in the 1970s may have tempered it a bit. Every so often, in one of his sort of revealing moments, he goes back and smacks at the Roosevelt legacy and so on. But you were going to say, sorry, we did cut you off. We did,
no,
Joe.
I was just going to say, it's like our senses have been deranged to a point where people will say, FDR's New Deal, you know, Republicans will say, oh, that was socialism. And I just think to myself, how did we get to this point where, you know, I have to be honest, to me, today's conservatives, I don't even know what they're trying to conserve. It seems like they're more just trying to wreck everything in sight. It seems to have little in common with like Russell Kirk or Edmund Burke.
Russell Kirk, sorry, don't get too soft about Russell Kirk.
Fair enough.
Please. You know, there's this tendency, and it's not just among young people who've maybe read more even than I have, but there's this tendency, surely you've seen this effort to say nice things about George W. Bush, right?
Yes.
Oh my God. In fact, George W. Bush's lies have led to the murder of millions of people in the Middle East. I mean, I remember my friend John Fugelsang, who's got the nightly radio show on Sirius XM and his own podcast, Sanity Cast. He and I were talking one day, and we both agreed on how vile Donald Trump was. But he said, but don't forget, George W. Bush probably caused the deaths of far, far, far more people than Donald Trump will do so, at least for now.
I guess I'm not trying to be like too soft.
Sorry, but you are right. There's okay. There are conservatives now, clearly. They're not even conservatives anymore. Maybe that's the way to look at it.
It's almost like they're Ayn Rand libertarians.
Conservative. These guys are reactionaries. And that's a word we lost touch with before you were born. So when I was growing up, it's a silly way of putting it, but they used to put everything on a continuum, right? So you had, you know, sort of the centrists, and you had liberals, and you had conservatives, and you move further out, and there were these radicals, and on the right, it was reactionaries, period. The conservatives weren't the far right, but what's happened is we lost touch with that beautiful word, reactionary, okay? Just like we've lost term with the word white supremacist, who we seem to have somehow found their way back into the Senate under the guise of conservatism. Yeah, so I agree with you. I think there's been a real derangement. Now, it's interesting to realize that if you tell people that their Social Security is in jeopardy, they will become radicals in an instant, mm-hmm. right? Just like that. But then they don't connect Social Security with the struggles of the 30s. They don't connect Social Security with the whole idea of social democracy. Moreover, tell people you're going to go after their Medicare, and they'll rise up in anger. Older folks. Medicare is part of Social Security, right? It's the further enhancement of Social Security. By the way, Franklin Roosevelt, when he first envisioned Social Security, intended to include universal health care in it. And the only reason he ended up having to pull it out because the American Medical Association, in its ever-reactionary fashion, said, we will come out completely in opposition to it, and all of our patients will listen to us kind of stuff. And big business, as much as they had a very hard time responding to so many of Roosevelt's initiatives, were prepared to mobilize against it. And this is the other key thing, Southern Democrats, as much as they may have liked the New Deal for the money it sent into the utterly impoverished South, they did not like the idea of national health care because they were convinced it would lead to the desegregation of hospitals.
I guess on that note, and then we'll switch over to current events.
Sure.
The thing that gets me, and maybe this is why I find FDR impressive, all his faults aside, is that there's that old Thatcher quote, there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals. And I view that as one of the most despicable statements I have ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
That society is the only thing that really... You know, it's the reason we are where we are today as a civilization.
Right.
And FDR seemed to understand that instinctively. And that is impressive, given that what we have today is so far removed from that idea of, you know, a collective society where we have to take care of each other
yeah.
on some level. That right. is, to me, right. FDR's legacy.
As you probably saw in the speeches, regularly he makes the case that we are not isolated individuals. That our very existence requires us to recognize our interdependence and to generate solidarities based on that fact, okay? And it's interesting, as a sidebar, since I used to work on British studies so much and I lived in Thatcher's Britain for a while, is that Margaret Thatcher was constantly promoting the idea of British values. And how could you possibly talk about values if you didn't imagine them emanating from society? Government doesn't create values. So society, culture creates values. So, you know, she was a brilliant propagandist, which is why she lasted in power as long as she did.
Well, one more thing with regards to FDR. I have to mention the most famous quote of FDR's that I always hear, and maybe you can give some context to my listeners, is I had someone that was like, you should ask Harvey about this particular quote, the only thing to fear is fear itself, because I think that's a quote that's really resonant for a lot of people right now.
That is a great quote, and it's the one time of all the times the more I came to understand Roosevelt, and one has to read Eleanor Roosevelt sometimes to make sure you understand Franklin Roosevelt.
Can I comment real quickly on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to say I feel that a lot of people often forget about Eleanor. She was a great first lady, and I think she played a huge role in FDR's presidencies.
Yeah, they actually had, by the let me remind me to come back to Eleanor before we move on. But this that quote is, of course, given in his inaugural address of 1933. Okay, and that was back when the inaugurations used to occur in March as opposed to in January. And I don't think he actually meant it when he said it, or at least he meant it to the extent that if we rally to the occasion, if we create these solidarities to literally pursue our attack on the Great Depression as if we were at war with the Great Depression and the power, by the way, and the forces that brought it upon us. I mean, that was his own way of saying, let's be prepared to go to war with those who brought this kind of situation upon us, which Obama didn't do. And he was inaugurated. He tried to say, we're all responsible. No, Franklin Roosevelt made it clear who was responsible and pointed a finger in the direction of the bankers and the financiers and those who ran down the economy. But when he said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, he knew there was a lot of reason to fear. The point was that the only way to overcome fear is to become directly involved in the fight and not to sit back and let the anxiety wear you out. Yeah.
And I know you said you wanted to go back to Eleanor. I actually wanted to ask about Eleanor Roosevelt because, like I said, I think she gets forgotten about a lot of times. And I feel like she played a really important role in Franklin's life.
Yes. Well, in fact, I mean, so in spite of the fact that she discovered he was having an affair back during World War One, okay, in spite of that, they stayed together for the remainder of their his life. And then after that, she literally represented the Roosevelt legacy and became probably the most famous woman in the world. But I also want to point out, this is interesting, she was very progressive, and her range of activities and contacts were a real inspiration to working people. So she wrote essentially a daily column on politics and culture while she was the first lady. She spoke fervently in favor of civil rights and acted in favor of civil rights. When she was writing that column, she actually joined a journalist labor union. I think it was called the Newspaper Guild, not Newspaper Guild. I'm forgetting the title of it. I should know it. It's shame on me. But the point is, she was a progressive. Now, what's also interesting is, once upon a time, he was the far more progressive figure in the early years of their marriage. In fact, she was known to make anti-Semitic and racist remarks back in the 19-teens. But in the 1920s, when Franklin was stricken with polio, she was the one who got out and spent a lot of time in New York City working with groups like the Women's Trade Union League. And some of her closest friends were East European Jewish socialist women organizers in the textile industries. So she brings them back to Hyde Park and to their house in New York, which they were in quite a while too. And so in some ways, she becomes all the more progressive, even in a labor direction. And this also then encourages his thinking about labor and social democracy. It's very, very clear. So then when she's first lady, as I said, she's really out there. And in fact, there was an Eleanor scholar and another Roosevelt biographer who said to me, you know, their relationship required her to do the things that he couldn't do because he couldn't walk without his crutches or his assistance by someone holding his arm. And he had to wear, you know, braces on his legs to be able to stand and appear to be walking. And so quite often he would do his campaigns from the back seat of an open air vehicle, a convertible. And they would pull into a town or by train, and she would come off the train or come out of the car, and she would move among the crowd or go into a workplace or go into the stores while he would talk to the people nearby in the crowds. And that way they could compare notes as to what people thought and what people wanted and what they actually needed of a political leader. So they were a real, really, truly amazing partnership in politics, I have to say. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I learned because of friends of mine who are Eleanor scholars is, don't fail to talk about Eleanor. Okay, never fail to do that.
Well, I always felt like I've told people before, I'm like, Eleanor Roosevelt was a really badass first lady. So I'm glad we got to talk about that.
She's the greatest first lady we've ever had. Absolutely.
Casey, before we move on to talking a little bit about the upcoming presidential election. Anything you wanted to ask Harvey about the FDR book?
No, not particularly, but I thought a good segue would be a combination of two quotes I pulled from, I think, Chapter 39, we have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
We are united in determination that this war shall not be followed by another interim which leads to new disaster, that we shall not repeat the tragic errors of ostrich isolationism, that we shall not repeat the excesses of the wild 20s when this nation went for a joyride on a roller coaster, which ended in a tragic crash. And, however, while the majority goes on about its great work without complaint, a noisy minority maintains an uproar of demands for special favors for special groups. Yes, they're pests like who swarm. It's rhyming with today, kind of, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it does. Yes.
I think it rhymes a lot. I was going to say the bit about not going into isolationism, which I'm seeing a lot more people, especially with coronavirus, say, oh, you know, China this, China that. It seems like we're becoming much more isolationist. Both Democrats and, well, Republicans have been isolationists for a while. But it's a very scary moment. I feel like we're repeating the mistakes of the past. And also, you mentioned the joyride of the 20s that led to a huge crash. I mean, inequity is skyrocketing still.
Right. Yeah, well, for a start, we often get a misunderstanding of the 20s because of that term roaring 20s, as if everybody was doing really well in the 1920s. But actually, for a start, and most Americans were still living in rural areas, and they were, you know, the population of farmers was immense. Farmers had never recovered from the recession following World War I. And working people, even though the household incomes improved, the fact is the only way they improved is that at least two people in every household had gone out to work. And so, in other words, the households themselves were under strain. Two people were going out to work, if not the kids as well, and to some degree. And that's how the household incomes went up. So when the Depression hit, I mean, it was devastating. Women obviously were going to lose their jobs first, but then maybe get hired sooner again because they were cheaper labor. When people lost their jobs, having never really accumulated the kind of savings that the so-called roaring 20s might imply, I mean, times were really, really were going to be tough. So, yeah, I mean, in our case, we've come to realize that I forget the percentage. I mean, Bernie talked about it. A lot of left folks, my peers, have talked about it. What is it? Most Americans had no more than a few hundred dollars in reserve in case some kind of crisis struck their families. I mean, yeah, you know, call it the roaring 80s and 90s and even 2000s up until the Great Recession. And the fact is that maybe those weren't as good for most people. And when we look closely, they weren't. Working people didn't see a rise in the standard of living, at least working men, since the early 1970s. And if you put households into that, basically the only reason household income might have gone up is you had two members of the family working. No, I mean, the rich have gotten it's not even the rich anymore. These plutocratic, you know, four-letter words come to mind, who literally, you know, the billionaires, even in some cases, multi-billionaires. I mean, and they have become the aristocracy, or as Roosevelt put it, the economic royalists, that he called them back in the 30s. And he said, you know, I welcome their hatred. Well, sure as hell, I would have liked people along the way, such as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, to say, I sure as hell would love for the rich to hate me, because I'd like to make sure that I help you folks all the more. And they didn't, period. Bernie was the only one, I believe, who was more than welcome to it. He actually did welcome the hatred of the plutocrats and if you like, the neoliberal Democrats.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the 1920s thing. I always remember when we would read in school those F. Scott Fitzgerald books, like The Great Gatsby. I think I was the only person in the class who would say, wow, these people are like wealthy, and it's like, their wealth is almost grotesque, like the depiction of it.
Sure.
And I think it's lost on people how grotesque that wealth inequality was in the 1920s.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, there's a show we escape to. We sometimes escape into these shows on HGTV. Mm-hmm. And there's one called, I hate to admit I watched this, Bahamas Life. And these people who go off to buy homes in the Bahamas, which, by the way, are not even as expensive as you might imagine. But nevertheless, who the hell can afford $500,000 or $1 million to buy some really nice place in the Bahamas and keep one back home in North Carolina or whatever else? I mean, you know, I remember when I was in college, there used to be an expression, come the revolution. You ever heard that expression? Come the revolution. Come the revolution, we'll take care of all this. So I remember when Bernie Sanders coined the term political revolution, and then his organization, Our Revolution, back in the 2015-16, and after that, that came to mind, come the revolution.
I guess, moving into current events, I feel like we need a real political revolution right now, because I'm so annoyed with, how do I put this? We're stuck with two characters who I'm just not very fond of, Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
If that's all you can say is not very fond of, Casey, you take care of this guy, okay?
it's like the things I want to say to express my frustration, I can't, because then we'd have to include a trigger warning and there'd be wellness checks, and we don't want to deal
okay,
with that.
Gotcha.
But it's
okay.
It's just okay, a whole. Right. Like, why did we get to this point?
You can blame my generation if you wish.
No, because generational politics is a dead end. But I don't know where else to go, though.
I agree with you in good part. I love when I hear, you know, progressive folks who are in their 40s and 50s say, the future is ours. These young people are so progressive, if not socialist. And when they get older, you know, they'll be the majority. All I can tell you is, my generation thought of itself as the radical generation, and sure as hell, we're not in our you know post 60 age.
Well, Harvey, what is your take on the election and Joe Biden? I know you have some nuanced views on it. You've released a statement.
Yeah. Well, okay. So a few weeks ago, after Bernie was clearly I know he hasn't closed the campaign, but he withdrew from the campaign and he endorsed Biden. Okay, now look, we could talk about what happened, and did we talk right after all that debacle, or in the midst of that debacle the last time we spoke?
It was in the midst of it, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty clear that Barack Obama literally called up all the candidates and said, "You got to stop. You got to pull out. You got to endorse Joe. I mean, if we don't create unity, I mean, basically." He may not have been terribly fond of Joe, but he knew that he had to act, or God forbid, Bernie Sanders might win. I mean, let's face it, the Democratic leadership, the Democratic establishment was willing, I'm convinced, was willing to lose to Trump before they were willing to go with Bernie Sanders. Let me just say that clearly. So once Bernie pulled out, the question is, where do people like me, where do we go? What are we going to do? And I can tell you, as I showed you in my public statement, look, we're in the middle of a crisis upon a crisis right now. And what have we seen? We've seen a moron, I think I used this term earlier, we've seen a moron not only ignore the developing crisis, ignore it, we've also seen him at first try to offer some supposed cure, some you know drug that was going to be a cure-all for this crisis. Turned out that in some cases where they experimented with it, they actually killed people. And then more recently, he had the audacity. Man, he's so disgusting and so vile to think that he actually in public talked about disinfectant as something that we might use as to consume that would fight the virus. I mean, God damn it. You know, he's truly, truly the worst president in anyone's memory, I am sure. And even to call him a president is a scurvy thing to say because, oh God, he's disgusting. Sorry, I had to say it, okay? even to think about him, just I want to vomit these days. So the thing is, given that we have not only a disgusting man in the presidency, we also have a man who wants to be a dictator, an authoritarian, in many ways, a fascist leader, perhaps like Mussolini.
I just wanted to add to that. See, that's the part that I find scary about Trump is I know a lot of liberals or Democrats that I speak to, they're more annoyed seemingly by how gauche he is. You know, he doesn't have the right cultural sort of tastes. What bothers me more is just his tendency towards authoritarianism. And I'm just glad that he's incompetent.
He was already in business an utter jackass and authoritarian jackass, okay? And he fooled a lot of – look, the whole game of real estate in New York, he mastered it, the ups and the downs, okay? And then he became a TV figure, right? Because really, you could write him off if he weren't president as a fascinating stand-up comic, period. But he's not. He's a president. He's in the White House, which makes him disgusting and dangerous. And because he's a wannabe dictator, a fascist deep down, okay, who literally, essentially embraced neo-Nazis in his first year in office, who has literally sort of allowed a virus to go unchecked, which is definitely harming and killing more people of color than anyone else. I mean, think about it. This man is just awful. And what he's done to the country, what we've allowed him to do, is just horrific. But so my feeling is, however deplorable Biden's record is as a neoliberal, I mean, truly deplorable, it still is the case that Trump is more despicable. Now, and I'm not just, it's not just a matter of splitting hairs or whatever they call it. It really is the case that if we want to make sure that we get to vote in November, or hopefully beyond November, if we get to vote again in 2022, if we get to vote again in 2024, then we better make sure that whoever the Democratic candidate is, we vote for that candidate. Now, I made my statement before the Tara Reid stuff came up. So I'm not averse to the idea that if it turns out to be true, that maybe they slide. I mean, my preference would always be Bernie Sanders. Look, I find Cuomo's record deplorable, but Cuomo or Biden, they're all far, far better than Trump. But here's another thing. This is the other thing. I think it is imperative that we realize that even as we vote for Biden, we're voting against Trump, and we should not forget how deplorable Biden's record is. But that means that between now and November and immediately beyond November, that we're prepared to act as critics and harassers and mobilizers of direct action against any kind of neoliberal democratic presidency. Okay, I mean, we lost our opportunity when the Democrats rallied and literally mobbed themselves against the Sanders campaign. And our trick now is literally to make sure we have it in our power to act politically after November. Because, look, 4 more years of Trump, if there's anything left of American democracy, I don't know what it'll be.
What do you feel is the connection between the pandemic and where we are at right now? I mean, I'm assuming the pandemic plays a huge role in why you would say maybe we should back Biden over Trump, or at least vote against Trump.
Yeah, well, I can imagine if we take away the pandemic for a moment, then I might still have felt the imperative of voting for whoever the Democrat is. What's the expression? Vote blue, no matter who. I think that's a bit too too free. You know, God, I can't believe we're reduced to Biden. Okay, having said that, I think it's the case that what we've seen is that we've so allowed these last few years a man to run wild inside of American government and to devastate not only American government's ability to respond to a crisis, but also has literally driven American ideas of possible futures into the ground. I mean, young people may be more progressive than some other generations of recent memory, but it's also the case they didn't turn out in the numbers they were supposed to turn out in to vote for Bernie. So, I mean, we have reason to believe that 3 years of Trump, in spite of the so-called resistance and its success in 2018, did not inspire great activism in the general population. I mean, and now in the crisis we're in, we're all sort of, you know, not in all the states down south and out west and other places, but so many of us are literally having to stay home and operate by Zoom and Skype and FaceTime. Having said that, I also think Zoom and FaceTime and Skype afford great opportunities for organizing and for mobilizing. And I see a lot of great podcasts such as yourselves, radio shows. I do a radio show every Friday called the Jeff Santos Show. It comes out of Boston, reminiscent of the Ed Schultz shows of the past. I mean, a populist progressive show. I mean, we're in a moment where we can actually try to re-engage American thinking, not because of the possibility of a political revolution. We don't have the Bernie Sanders campaign for that right now, but we've got to mobilize to make sure that we don't literally, A, allow a Trump presidency to go on another 4 years, and B, allow neoliberalism to take hold again in Washington, D.C. under the Democrats.
Casey, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, on some level, I can't help but think the election is 6 months away, so why do we have to stick with Biden? Like you said, there are so many other choices, and the vast majority of them don't carry nearly as much baggage as him. And, of course, none of them are as good as Sanders, but like you said, fuck, they're probably better than Trump.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of, like, I think people on a more radical left perspective, people that were, a large number of whom were like the people that phone banked for Bernie, that donated whatever they could, that were like the grassroots aspect of the movement, they're left wondering, how is it that we can expect to drag the establishment, drag the Democratic Party to the left if they consistently stymie us like this?
And I'm going to answer your question.
Yeah, I'd like the answer, honestly.
And I'm going to go back to something that Joe mentioned before we began tonight. So you interviewed Chris Smalls, right?
Yep.
There's energy in the labor movement. By the way, no labor movement, you can write off the left completely. There is no left without the labor movement. And the AFL-CIO in itself has been a long time since it's really been a movement. It's this energy from below, the likes of Chris Smalls. By the way, Sarah Nelson, the airline flight attendant, a friend of mine, she's my candidate for the next president of the AFL-CIO. Some people say, would you like to see her as Secretary of Labor? Hell no.
I love that you bring up Sarah. Only tangentially related, I saw a tweet of hers earlier today about a video of honeybees attacking wasps.
Yes.
And how they, like...
Yes.
It's just
great.
Like...
Absolutely. Yeah. I retweeted
that. She's exactly the kind of person the AFL-CIO could needs in moments of crises like this, especially considering her leadership during the last major government shutdown.
The government shutdown. And by the way, if you're at all interested, and anyone listening, you'll get a real sense of who she is if you go onto YouTube and plug in Sarah Nelson speaks to DSA. I believe it was the DSA she spoke to in Chicago, something like that. It is a great speech. It's the kind of speech that puts Sarah, that really created the friendship between us, because she has a real sense of history and a developing sense of history, the kind of sense of history that I wish Bernie had spoken to all the more when he was running. So, I mean, I think the question is, you know, if you want to do something to encourage the next political revolution, or at least a political revolution, you align yourselves with labor. If anyone's listening, I can tell you, if you're in a workplace where there's a union, you join it and you speak up. If you're in a workplace where people such as yourselves would like a union, you seek to organize one and you contact one of the unions that will probably be willing to send you an organizer to figure out how to proceed. I mean, organizing labor is the only way we truly take back America. Because remember, we place too much emphasis on the White House. And we don't place enough attention on the workplace.
I wanted to comment on that. I also think, I know you mentioned Zoom and Skype and mobilizing through podcasts. I think sometimes, I think some people, especially the younger folks on the left, may put too much emphasis on, oh, there's all these great leftist podcasts. And it's really great that there are. But it doesn't stop there. You have to organize in your communities. You have to organize in your workplaces. It's not enough to just say, oh, I'm going to listen to Chapo Trap House or Michael Brooks or Parallax Views. We have to do more, and we have to be engaged in our communities.
Right. Here's what I mean by that. If you go, I don't watch cable news any longer. MSNBC is just sucks. Period. Who could possibly listen to that stuff? But let me give you a day and a week to think about. And by the way, the role of the folks of podcasts is not to organize. The role is to create the sense of solidarity that you're not alone, and to encourage that kind of activity. So think about this. So in the morning, you've got the likes of Crystal Ball on Rising, Hill TV Live. Go midday, you've got Majority Report with Sam Cedar, who's accompanied by Michael a few days and Nomiki Konst. Go later in the day, and I know various people like some of these people I'm mentioning and others don't. And then you've got the Young Turks. And then you've got, I know you, Joe, do at least a weekly. Michael Brooks does more than a weekly now. Michael Brooks is lined up with Anna Kasparian and Jacobin Magazine. They're doing a Saturday one now. Nomiki Konst has launched a YouTube one. I mean, this isn't a matter of bragging about it, but I'm busy every week doing like four or five shows a week. And some of them are big. Some of them are moving up, such as your own. Some of them are still small down and localized. Like there's Highlands Bunker. You know that out of Baltimore?
You know what? I just found that show because I was looking up recent shows that you did.
Right. And then there's Good Morning Comrade, which is a morning radio show in the New Orleans area. So all I'm getting at is there's this amazing network. In fact, I would love to be, I don't organize these kinds of things, but it'd be great to have some kind of sort of national conclave or gathering of podcasters and radio people and others just to see to what extent there could be some sense of even if it's a matter of organizing some news service that everybody can grab hold of. Nicole Sandler has been, campaigning as an independent radio voice, originally on AM, now, online. Again, I'm not saying that we've got the answer by way of all of this stuff, but what I am getting at is organizing in your community or in your workplace, you're not alone, and there are all these places. So, for example, you brought Chris Smalls on, right? He's been making the rounds right now. People are going to come to know that there is labor activity. Let's not forget, it was only a couple of years ago that the West Virginia teachers walked out in a state that has been decidedly anti-union for a long time, and even the UMW in its day had to fight for its survival. And you had other state teachers' organizations and city teachers' organizations, and all of them, of course, may be inspired by the Chicago Teachers Union. What I'm getting at is there is an incredible percolation of activity, and you wouldn't know it from mainstream media. The only way you're going to get it is by attending to the shows that I talked about during the day, the podcasts. You don't only have on the likes of me, the sort of academic intellectual, who, by the way, is a labor unionist. You also have on a guy who literally tried to organize or at least lead a protest in Amazon. And I believe, did Chris get to the idea that he's been in contact with Amazon people overseas? I mean, I want people to realize that it isn't over. And the trick is I'm not pushing a Biden candidacy. I know Casey would like to see someone else, but Biden may be the only one who makes it through the next couple of months, unless Tara Reid's story turns out to be not only true. Well, if Tara Reid's story turns out to be true, then you can be assured that the Democrats are going to have to hustle pretty quickly, since they've already all lined up behind Biden. You can imagine what's at stake there. But we need a Democrat in the presidency so that we can mobilize. When I was going to write my book about American radicalism that turned into Take Hold of Our History, I assumed Hillary Clinton was going to be president, and labor and left were going to have to organize to make sure that she knew we were there and couldn't get away with being a neoliberal like her husband.
You know, I wanted to add too. I wasn't trying to imply that, oh, this podcasting stuff isn't good. I was just saying, I know a lot of young people that are like, well, it's cool that I listen to these podcasts. And I'm like, but it's going to require more than that. I think the alt media provides a sense of solidarity, but it's a starting point, I think, for a lot of people. The only other thing I wanted to mention was with regards to Joe Biden, one of the things I've heard from Democrats, and it's sort of just got me riled up lately, is I've had some people even say, the vote blue no matter who types, you can't even criticize Biden because that will hurt his chances. And I'm just like, well, what? I mean, you're literally telling progressives we can't do anything. You know, just shut up and take it sort of type thing. And I'm not going to morally judge anyone for however they vote in November, but I it's just a really frustrating situation, I guess.
Hold on. Here's what I say. Look, right now, Biden is ahead of Trump in some key states, for what it's worth in the polls. But the most important thing is this. Biden's not going to win because he's Joe Biden. Biden's going to win because he isn't fucking Donald Trump.
I mean, I think that's the strategy right now.
That's not a bad strategy.
But then what it means is Biden's going to have to learn how to do just that and not fall back on old stuff. I mean, look, I would love it if Biden said, look, I'm not the man for the job. Okay. But this guy's been egomaniacally oriented toward the presidency for longer than you guys have been alive. And I used to joke about the fact, I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you, Joe, the only time I truly liked him was when he was caught plagiarizing Neil Kinnock, the head of the Labour Party in Britain, because at least I figured he plagiarized, you know, a social democrat, right?
It's funny you bring that up. We did a show yesterday where we were reading a long article about Joe Biden and Tara Reid, and there's an excerpt
Gold from... Current Affairs wrote that article. Yeah.
There's an excerpt from one of the speeches he plagiarized from the British MP, wherein he said, I'm the first member of my family to attend university in 1,000 generations. And he just never cut that out.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I'm laughing through my tears right now, you might say. But look, I mean... You know, I can tell you that somebody said to me, this radio fellow, Jeff Santos, that I work with, he said to me, what do you think about a Michelle Obama candidacy? And I can tell you, I don't want a Michelle Obama candidacy, not only because I don't think she's worth having as a candidate, okay, which I know sounds like a sin. She has no experience in politics. She's the wife of a neoliberal whose own behavior in the White House was that of a neoliberal lady.
I have to be honest. It sounds slightly better than I've heard some people say. Maybe we should run Oprah Winfrey or Mark Cuban, which I'm like, whoa.
That's how pathetic the Democratic Party and Democrats have become. But the other reason is this, and I'm going to go back to something I said earlier. We need a president who garners no affection. Look, Barack Obama garnered affection. And Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, never spoke up against Obama for failing to support the labor movement effectively. He ignored our struggle here in Wisconsin when we occupied the Capitol. I'm talking about Obama. He never pursued in any major fashion the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have enabled unions to organize more effectively and more easily, against right-to-work laws. I mean, the fact is that part of our problem was that Barack Obama was too well-liked, and thus leaders of significant forces could not directly challenge him. We do not want a popular Democratic president. We want a president candidate who can win against Trump, and then somebody that we can go after in favor of pushing this country, labor and the left, in a more progressive direction. That's my position.
Well, I can completely understand that position. Before you go, I just wanted to pick your brain on one more thing, and that's
I always love when we say we're going to do like 40 or 50 minutes, and then we...
I'm sorry. I had to get in.
Look, I enjoy talking to you guys. I could go on all evening, which is my problem.
I just wanted to mention that the main thing that worries me about Republicans and Democrats right now is that there's almost like this narrative of ultra-national rebirth in both parties. Like the Republicans are like, let's go back to the 1950s, make America great again. And the Democrats are like, why can't we just have a third Obama term? We need to get things to go back to normal, whatever normal means. And
God forbid.
This idea that we're just going to go back to the period before, all this bad point, whether it be you know, I don't know what Republicans think the bad point was. I think they just want to go back to the 1950s, a mythical version of it.
No,
I think
Democrats
have a mythical idea of
Obama.
Listen to Casey. The Republicans and the Democrats have, in certain respects, taken us back to the late 19th century already. And thus, the question is not to go back. The question is, we desperately need to go forward. Okay. And anyone who thinks the 1950s were the time to go back to, I mean, I had a great childhood in the 50s, but I wasn't a black kid growing up in the South. Okay. I was a white kid growing up in the New York area. And then in the 1960s, I mean, my generation likes to think it create, you know, it was the first generation that had sex, drugs and rock and roll, but that's definitely not the case. You don't ever want to go back. You know, I used to tell my students, you don't want to go back if only because you don't want to go to the dentists of the past. How's that?
The thing is, I don't even want to go back to, I mean, I don't want to go back to 2008 either.
We don't want another Obama two-term presidency. We want a Bernie Sanders or an AOC presidency.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. Harvey, if you could, how can my listeners get a hold of the new book, FDR on Democracy?
Okay, FDR on Democracy. You go online and you go to bookshop.org. It'll give you a whole host of possibilities. Or Indie Books, I think it's called. Or Barnes & Noble to avoid the Amazon story. But I'll tell you what, if you go straight to Skyhorse Publishing, to just plug in Harvey J.K. or FDR on Democracy, it'll take you to that page and it'll give you options that will then take you to a bookseller if you want to avoid the evil Amazon, okay?
Or I got to say, Skyhorse is one of the most underrated publishers out there today, so I recommend people visit Skyhorse's website.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to say is that if anybody's interested in contacting me, I'm not on Facebook, but I am on Twitter very actively, Harvey J.K., and I'll look forward to hearing from you if you contact me.
Thank you again, Harvey K.
Good to see you guys. Great to see you guys. Let's hope we can do it in a couple of months outside of a virus, right?
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Harvey J.K., curator of the new book, FDR on Democracy, The Greatest Speeches and Writings of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Give it a read, folks. And, of course, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Twitter. Just released a video version of the very interview you just heard, so if you're more into the video interviews, definitely subscribe to the Parallax Views Patreon. We also have other bonus content, including the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was. New episode should be going up today or tomorrow at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff It's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.